1 o'clock. Here is Topical Currents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents on this Monday afternoon. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we're in our At Your Service mode. The topic is Alzheimer's disease and the latest information about its prevention and perhaps treatment. We have experts on hand. First is Dr. Mark Agronin. He's an adult and geriatric psychiatrist and medical director for mental health and clinical research at the Miami Jewish Health Systems. He's also a professor of psychiatry and neurology at the University of Miami. Thanks for coming back. It's always good to see you, Dr. Mark.
Thank you so much.
Welcome. Also with us is Natalie Rubenstein. She's a clinical social worker and geriatric care manager and is a facilitator for Alzheimer's Association Support Group. She's also the author of Alzheimer's Disease and Other Dementias, The Caregiver's Complete Survival Guide. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Doctor, I'd like to start with you. Would you kindly explain the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease and define each of them?
Sure. Dementia is a general category for a brain disease which involves primarily memory impairment, but also impairment in several other areas, including language function, recognition of familiar people and places and things, the ability to carry out our daily activities, and finally our executive, that's our ability to have good insight and judgment and planning. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. So roughly 60 to 70% of individuals with dementia have Alzheimer's disease. And I would liken it to if you went to your doctor and he said, well, you have an infection, the question would be, what sort of infection do I have? So if someone has been diagnosed with a dementia, the logical question is, well, what sort of dementia do you have? And again, Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of it, but there are other forms of dementia, such as caused by stroke and various other diseases.
We're at your service today, so we're going to give out the number if you have a question or comment. We already have some emails, which we will get to. The number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio at WLRN.org, or you can also tweet us at Topical Currents.
Doctor, typically, when do Alzheimer's symptoms appear?
The main risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is age. And so most individuals develop early symptoms after the age of 65. We call this late onset Alzheimer's disease. Roughly 5% of the population has Alzheimer's disease around the age of 65, and this doubles every 5 years. So by the time you get to individuals 85 and above, you're talking about nearly 50% of the population suffering from this. A much smaller percentage, maybe 5 to 10% of individuals develop an early onset form of this before the age of 65. So this is much less common, and usually there are certain genetic factors involved. But one thing I want to emphasize is that the day someone presents with symptoms is not actually the day that this disease began, because our current understanding is that the pathology of this, the disease process, begins years, if not decades, before individuals first present with symptoms.
You said there is a genetic factor. What are the other risk factors, and are there ethnic groups that are more susceptible and more vulnerable?
Think about it this way. Anything that can damage your heart can damage your brain. And so diabetes, hypertension or high blood pressure, obesity, all of these factors can lead to brain damage, and those are big risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. Old age, I mentioned, is the number one risk factor. Actually, being female after menopause is a risk factor for it as well.
Why is that? Because of hormonal changes?
Likely because of the loss of estrogen. We know that estrogen works as a very powerful stimulant of the growth of our brain cells, and so with the loss of estrogen at menopause, it likely has a negative impact on that.
That's horrible, because there are so many reasons that women can take estrogen because of the cancers.
It's true. It's a very controversial issue, because some early data actually suggested that women who were on estrogen replacement therapy had lower rates of Alzheimer's disease. Then another study came out suggesting that the rates were higher. It's confusing enough that typically doctors don't recommend estrogen replacement therapy in this case.
Do not.
They do not.
Okay, and Natalie Rubenstein, you have decades of experience as a geriatric care manager, but many of those years were very personal to you. Could you tell us about your experience with your mom?
Approximately 30 years ago, my mother developed Pick's disease. At the time, she wasn't diagnosed with Pick's. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
What is Pick's disease?
Actually, Dr. Agrona would probably be the best at explaining exactly what Pick's disease is. I have my own way of explaining it, but I think for the viewers, the listeners, it'll be better for Dr. Agrona.
It's similar to Alzheimer's disease in that it's a brain disease that involves cognitive impairment that progresses over time, but it primarily affects the frontal lobes of the brain, and so a lot of the symptoms affect our behavior and our language function.
What are the physical effects on the brain from Alzheimer's? I've read about this plaque business and that. What's actually going on internally?
Sure. If you go back to the very first case report by Dr. Alois Alzheimer, who was a German psychiatrist, what he found is what we still look for. Two things are happening. Inside our brain cells, we see an abnormal protein build up and basically destroy the cells from the inside. Outside our brain cells, there's another protein called beta amyloid. This is building up, forming these clumps throughout the brain. The brain tries to deal with it, tries to create an inflammatory process, which leads to further damage. So if you look at a brain microscopically, you see these little protein clumps scattered throughout the brain. If you look at it on a larger level, you see an incredible loss of cells. So the brain shrinks over time, and all the networks that we rely upon for memory, for speech, for recognition, all of these begin to degenerate over time. Roughly over an 8 to 12 year period of time, individuals have symptoms. Now, as I mentioned before, we know this process begins much earlier than we get symptoms.
And what makes it fatal? Does it finally affects the respiratory system and the heart? Or?
It's interesting that the disease itself is not what kills people. But think about it this way. When you slowly lose not only your cognitive abilities, but even your ability to swallow, and so it puts individuals at risk of aspirating material into their lungs, they can get pneumonia. Their nutrition is poor, so they are at a greater risk for infection as well. So it's typically other symptoms, other disease states like that, a pneumonia, infection that leads to the death. And a recent study now pointed out it's the third leading killer in the United States right after heart disease and cancer.
You know, I always thought of it as a chronic disease, so I was very surprised to just read that it's a fatal disease. I guess I never thought of Alzheimer's as a fatal disease.
In the last roughly 6 to 12 months of this disease, individuals enter really a vegetative state. They no longer communicate. They are unable to walk. At a certain point, they're unable to swallow very well. And that really heralds the very last portion of this. It's often now when we get hospice services involved with individuals.
Natalie Rubenstein, tell us more about the effects that this disease has on families and loved ones.
That's a really good topic. Basically, when you're dealing with a person who has any form of Alzheimer's disease or dementia, it's for family members, your first thought is fear. You go into denial. You don't really accept what's going on, not knowing where to turn, who to go to for help is devastating because you try to do everything by yourself. You either do it by yourself or you listen to friends. Other people have taken care of a person with dementia. And like I've always said, if I got a dollar for every person who told me I know all about this disease, I took care of my mother, my brother, my father, my sister-in-law, my auntie, I wouldn't have had to have written a book because everybody would know so much about it. What ends up happening is that we don't realize that everybody's circumstances are different. Their relationships are different, their family is different. As Dr. Gronin said, their type of dementia is different. So when you see people, and I'm sure Dr. Gronin, you recognize this all the time, I get people telling me, oh, my mother was just diagnosed. But what they're not saying is, and my next question is, diagnosed with what? And where on the spectrum of this diagnosis is this person currently? Because for most of us, we would think it's at the very beginning. Oftentimes, by the time people do get diagnosed, it's the middle to end stages. The person's had dementia for years, and the family didn't even either recognize it or not know what they could do about it.
But we can still have senior moments, but not necessarily have dementia.
Correct.
Well, how do we know, what is normal memory loss versus what is dangerous and should be tested and pursued and abnormal?
Well, with my clients, normal memory loss might be forgetting where you put your car keys, forgetting where you put your purse,
your
wallet.
Why did I come into this room?
But we all do that. When it becomes more dangerous, it's when I get the phone calls that mom got lost while she was driving, somebody left the stove on, the water had been running and flooded a bathroom. They start getting concerned because maybe mom is forgetting. I'm using mom, obviously, but right. You know, mom's forgetting names of family members, doctor's appointments. And the reason that's so important is if somebody's forgetting their doctor's appointments, they're most probably also forgetting to take their medication properly.
We need to take a break, but you want to add something, Doctor?
Natalie makes a really good point that this can look different in different people. And so that's why we have memory centers. It's important to get an evaluation.
So we'll talk about memory centers. We are speaking about Alzheimer's today, and we're also going to be taking calls and emails with Dr. Mark Agronin of the University of Miami and mental health and clinical research at the Miami Jewish Health Systems. And Natalie Rubenstein is a clinical social worker and geriatric care manager and a facilitator for Alzheimer's Association support groups. Stay with us.
Point, click, and purchase have replaced browse, look, and buy for many book lovers. The endless online inventory and the ease of electronic readers have put the book business under pressure. What's the future of libraries? I'm Tom Hudson. Join us tonight at 7 for an encore edition of The Sunshine Economy, Buy and Borrow, the business of books and libraries in South Florida, made possible by Kaufman Rawson.
An adventure into the world of pop culture takes place at the Boca Museum of Art at Meisner Park, Boca Raton, now through April 23rd, with works featuring selections from the Frederick R. Weissman Art Foundation, an exhibition of works by pop art icons like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, James Rosenquist, and more. More information is available about other programs and events online at bocamuseum.org.
Two-time Grammy nominee Seraphic Fire presents Haydn's masterpiece, Seven Last Words. The Spectral Quartet, which Time Out Chicago declares a chamber supergroup, joins Seraphic Fire for this once-in-a-decade performance. Concerts April 9 through 13 in Dade, Broward, and Boca Raton. Tickets at 305-285-9060 or seraphicfire.org.
And welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. We are at your service, and we're taking questions and calls about Alzheimer's disease with Natalie Rubenstein, who's a clinical social worker and geriatric care manager and has the company Alzheimer's Care Consultants. And Dr. Mark Agronin is the medical director of mental health and clinical research at the Miami Jewish Health Systems. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio at WLRN.org.
Let's take a first caller, then we'll get to emails. This is John in Miami. Hi there.
Hello, hi. My wife has been seeing a doctor over at UM for several years. She was diagnosed with dementia, likely Alzheimer's, and she's been getting worse. She's had all the tests, MRIs, psychoneurology tests, and all that. And I just wanted to get a better idea of what to expect, because now she's she can't write very well. She has trouble with language, and of course, memory too. But she's not to the point where she physically she's perfect. You know, she exercises and there's a lot of normal things still, but want to get an idea of what to expect and how long before she might get to that not being able to swallow and walk kind of stage. Mm.
Okay, let's get some answers, John.
The course is variable, and so it's difficult to really make any predictions, and it sounds like you are an excellent caregiver for her, which really makes a difference. We know that when a caregiver is doing better, the individuals with Alzheimer's disease do better. And so one thing we do at our memory center is try to support the caregivers through groups and whatnot. And so make sure that you get all the help that you need. Another thing is that when you keep someone physically healthy, and it sounds like your wife is in wonderful physical health, they do better over time. When you keep them involved in activities, whether it's social activities, mentally stimulating activities that are at their level, that makes a difference as well. So I don't want you to feel that you don't have some degree of control in terms of what that course will be. You have a good deal of control. And that's why it's so critical to work with an expert in this area. And that's exactly what Natalie and I do, that we provide guidance, coaching, whatever treatment people need to help maximize not only how the afflicted individual is doing, but also how they as a caregiver are doing.
So mm-hmm. How do you get involved in a memory center?
Well, first of all, they can call us anytime at Miami Jewish Health Systems. We do a comprehensive evaluation. If they live in other parts of South Florida, there are a number of other memory centers in the area. Go to an expert in this area.
Because mm-hmm. We have many listeners in Broward and Palm Beach, of course.
Yes, exactly. And there aren't a huge number, but there are several memory centers in South Florida. And the key thing is that you're meeting with someone who knows different forms of dementia inside and out. And so they're able to tell, is this normal or it's not? Natalie and I were discussing a case just a minute ago, a mutual patient who had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, and we did the workup and turned out he didn't. There were other causes of his memory impairment that could be actually treated and reversed. So that's why seeing an expert is so critical.
I want to get to the email, but is Alzheimer's, once you're diagnosed, is it irreversible? Is that it?
Yes, unfortunately, Alzheimer's disease, by definition, is a progressive disorder. Currently, there's no cure for it. So to the question that was called in, over time, it will progress. We can't say how long. On average, people can go 5, 10, 12 years, sometimes longer. It's difficult to predict, but it is incurable at this stage, and that's why we're engaged in a tremendous amount of research, not only to be able to improve symptoms, but to find a cure.
Reading over the material before today's program, though, it seems there is hope. What can you tell people to be hopeful about?
Sure. At Miami Jewish Health Systems, we've been involved in numerous clinical trials for the last 15 years. Right now, we have about 8 actively enrolling trials. So there have been 2 major changes over the past few years. Number one is we can diagnose people earlier. It used to be that you made a good guess based on their history. Now what we can do is, using a new type of brain scan, we can actually detect one of these toxic proteins I mentioned earlier, beta amyloid, in the brain ahead of time to give us a good sense that we are dealing with Alzheimer's disease. And so now we can see people earlier on in the course of the disease. The second change is that there are a number of different treatments which we hope will modify the disease course, slow it down. And so we do a lot of work with a form of immunotherapy, giving people antibodies to try to break up this protein and get rid of it and slow the disease down. And preliminary data appears to show a glimmer of hope.
And there are many benefits to early diagnosis, I presume?
Absolutely. Obviously, from the standpoint of research, you can get involved in a research trial, most of which only want people in early stages.
Oh.
But in addition to that, we know that when you diagnose it early, first of all, it solves the mystery people are facing. Often there are symptoms, they just don't know about it. Mm-hmm. There are certain medications that can help improve symptoms to some extent. You also can do all the important decision-making that needs to be done before the person loses the capacity to do that, to make certain that healthcare proxies are designated, to make sure that your financial planning is taking place. All of those things need to be done ahead of time. And this is often when Natalie and I work together, these are the important issues that we end up spending most of the time working at.
Well, I'd like to get to some of these emails I have more questions. Bruce says, my father has Alzheimer's and is in a facility that provides general care. He's moderate to late stage. He cannot speak, but we believe he has tooth pain. What are the options for dental care? Our family hesitates to sedate him, as we've been told that any form of anesthesia can be bad for him. Are there any other options?
These issues come up all the time, and you have to look at what are the risks and what are the benefits and make a decision on that basis. So if this is a dental issue that's going to cause a lot of pain and discomfort, and this is someone who's at a stage where they have many more years to go, it makes sense to do the dental work. Anesthesia sometimes can have negative effects. They tend to be temporary. Whereas if you're talking about, getting someone significant dental work that's really not going to make a big difference, might not be as critical an issue. But this is where families and doctors have to work together as partners to make these decisions.
You mentioned about financial planning. I'm wondering about the economic costs of this. How is this covered by insurance, Alzheimer's? Has the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, changed what's covered, what isn't? Just could you talk about the economics of it?
You've tapped into a critical issue. Currently, Alzheimer's disease is the single most expensive disease in this country, even outpacing heart disease and cancer. And at the same time, we spend about a 20th on research with Alzheimer's disease as we do with cancer and heart disease. So there's a big gap here that needs to be addressed. It's an enormous financial burden for caregivers, and Medicare will pay for every type of procedure you need. It will not pay for someone to come in and help you during the day. So lots of families end up impoverishing themselves trying to care for someone. It really is tragic at times.
Is there any legislation that could change that? Is there any movement to change that, that they wouldn't pay for the caregiver that's essential with the disease?
At this point, no. And I think anticipating the changes with the Affordable Care Act, I think there's a great fear of what these costs will be, but they're addressing them directly is not really built into the plan. Even if you look at the National Alzheimer's Disease Project Act, we're talking about funding in the $28 million range, which is really not going to help individual caregivers per se. It's more educational programs and promotion of the disease awareness over time.
I'm thinking that, you know, some people can't afford a caregiver like Natalie, you or your mother's caregiver. And of course, you're not compensated. You're a family member. And I'm just thinking about the people that have to quit work because they have to take care of a loved one.
And that's probably one of the biggest things I advocate, and it's long-term care insurance. And oftentimes it does, depending upon what your age is, you know, how affordable it's going to be. However, in the long run, as I've explained to some families, you know, spending $2,500 or $3,000 a year for services that you're going to recoup in 1 month definitely is a very good return on your investment. It makes your life more palatable and easier for many of us caregivers that are working and are raising families simultaneously. Taking the time off from work puts that at a huge detriment.
Right.
It affects everything. It affects your 401k. It affects your future income.
Right.
So for many of us, long-term care insurance is a lifesaver, but so many people do not get it when they should have it earlier.
Which is when they're younger.
When you're in your 50s, in your 60s, before you get diagnosed with anything serious, mm-hmm. that's the time to go for long-term care. If you're concerned that maybe a family member does have dementia, and you're concerned yourself about getting something down the road, then it's really important to go out and get it. I've had it for 10 years now, and my kids have it.
What about Medicare? Most of these patients obviously are qualified for Medicare.
Medicare is an insurance. Medicare pays for...
It doesn't pay for the caregiver.
Hospital, but not the care.
Correct.
And Medicaid?
Or nursing home.
Very rarely. There's Medicaid dollars are so few. So many people are under the misimpression that over time they'll just do estate planning and get a Medicaid bed. They've heard all these wonderful stories about nursing homes and Medicaid. Unfortunately, those beds are few and far between, and families don't realize that.
Let's take a call or two. Our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. First up, or second up, we have Laz in Miami. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to ask the doctor if I've been diagnosed with possible pre-onstage dementia. I have a lot of white heterogeneous patchy areas, and I'd like to know three very brief things. Is there a rising number of people developing early on stage or on stage dementia earlier in life, and is there any you know, alternative medicines or even pharmaceutical resources that can help people who don't have Alzheimer's but do have dementia or are in the process of developing dementia?
As we have recognized that the roots of this disease are much earlier, we're focusing more on younger individuals, either with symptoms or now that we have more advanced ways to scan the brain, we are picking up this much earlier. Unfortunately, at that stage, there's not a lot you can do in terms of medications or alternative medicine that really are going to make the difference, especially if you really don't have symptoms. The key thing is to be monitored over time. But I would say it does make sense to adopt what we call a brain healthy lifestyle. And this involves physical exercise, which is without question the best thing you can do. It helps brain function in many ways. Keep yourself healthy. If you have other disease states, make sure you treat those optimally. A diet rich in fruits and vegetables. Keeping mentally fit, socially fit. These are the essential ingredients. And you don't have to spend money on any fancy programs or supplements or, you know, there's a lot of people out there hawking different products, which in the end really don't make a difference at all. But this type of lifestyle will not only maximize how you're doing, but hopefully even will stave off symptoms.
Could Laz take part in these clinical research trials? Would he be a good candidate?
Possibly. He's actually the type of person that studies are looking for now. They want individuals who either have very mild symptoms or they're very concerned about it, because they can come in and get one of these new brain scans free that will show whether they have the buildup of this protein in the brain, and then they can actually get into a treatment early that might actually slow the disease down.
So what could you tell him and how he can find out?
Well, anyone interested can call our research hotline. It's 305-514-8710. We can tell them about the different studies.
Are you writing that down, Laz?
305-514-8710. And what we do is we conduct an interview on the phone to get a sense for whether you might fit for one of the trials. And then we have you come in and we do a screening. And the good news is a lot of people come in very worried. They have a screening, and we tell them, guess what? You don't qualify for a study because there is no evidence of Alzheimer's disease.
Are there vaccines under study?
Yes, we have. There have been two different vaccines studied. The first one, a little over 10 years ago, resulted in some very bad side effects, and that was stopped. They reformulated it. We just completed one of the studies of the vaccines, and we're waiting to hear some of the data on it. The immunotherapy that we're doing is similar to the vaccine. The vaccine is what we call active immunotherapy. Antibody infusion is a more passive form. Most of the research studies now are using this passive form of immunotherapy, and those are the studies that have shown some preliminary data indicating that we might be able to slow this disease down by up to 30% to 34%.
Laz also asked if more people are getting early onset.
There's really no indication of that. It just seems that we're picking up more of it.
I see.
Seems to be like when I was growing, I rarely heard about Alzheimer's, but I guess its life expectancy has increased. More people are put into that.
That's area. Made the difference. We're living longer, so more of us are in that critical zone. The other thing is that in the past, more people had vascular damage to their brain. We weren't as aware of lowering our cholesterol, blood pressure control, those different factors that often led to vascular damage. Were responsible for more dementias in the past. Nowadays, not so many.
Can we just get this email? Speaking of the blood pressure, Catherine wants to know if you could speak to whether or how much the use of statin drugs can cause Alzheimer's or dementia.
Sure. Well, statin medications, which are indicated for lowering cholesterol levels, we know that some trials have shown that people on statins tend to have lower rates of Alzheimer's disease. It may be because primarily by preventing strokes, you prevent a big risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. There's some indication that statins have a direct effect on preventing the buildup of this beta amyloid protein. Once you get Alzheimer's disease, there's no indication that a statin is going to help you in any way. But we don't recommend people go on statins to prevent Alzheimer's, but for the reasons that they're indicated. And then they get that secondary benefit.
Okay.
And another caller. This is Sam. He's in Plantation. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
In 2005, my wife, who was then 52 years old, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And a year later, she got one of those vaccines from Elon Pharmaceutical. I think it was called like AAC100. I think that was the code. There's a place that did experimental work up in Brain Matters up in Delray. Within a week or two, it was amazing. Her mini mental scores like improved by 30%. I mean, it was clearly working. It was a double blind, and she was a phase one, so we didn't know. Later, when they broke the code, she did, in fact, get it. And for about a year, she was doing great. We asked for, could you give us another injection? And we got the FDA runaround, why you can't do it. And then I heard that somehow or another that drug, and you may know about it, that they found problems with it, and they took it off the market, which made no sense to me, because the problem with Alzheimer's is it's going to kill you. I can't imagine too many things have a worse prognosis than that, and that most people would be more than happy to take the risk when they have a 100% fatal disease. I wonder if you know anything about what happened to that drug.
Sure. Well, one thing to point out is that all clinical trials are highly regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. So, you know, we are under very, very strict guidelines. Everything's under institutional review boards. And so if a study is open or shut, you know, the local, you know, we have to abide by that. And it's ultimately for the safety of the subjects. So this very first vaccine that you're talking about, which came out in about 10, 12 years ago, what happened was a number of individuals developed a reaction to it, ending up with inflammation of their brain, and there were about half a dozen deaths from it. So as you can imagine, when that happens, the clinical trial was stopped in its tracks. Now, you point out that some individuals may have had good results. We know from the data that people did appear to be responding, at least building up antibodies and mounting an immune response, but you know, you have to look at this ethically. If you had a vaccine that's going to help 10 people, but it's going to kill 10 people, I think in the end, that's not going to get approved. So what's happened was that this vaccine was reformulated, and those are the studies that we just completed. But again, the data is not out yet.
Natalie Rubenstein, besides getting long care health insurance, what other tips can you give family members who are just kind of starting out on this road?
Well, one of the things that I typically ask family members is, who diagnosed you? Oftentimes it's done by their general practitioner. So in which case then I refer them over to somebody like Dr. Mark Gronin to get a full workup. I think it's very important for family members. Also, we forget oftentimes that lack of sleep can mimic dementia. Depression can mimic dementia. Somebody who's having hearing loss might not be hearing you properly. Therefore, they're not going to remember things that they heard incorrectly. So there's a lot of things that we can do that basically we don't. Fear is a really big game changer. What happens is that so many people have heard so much about dementia now that the minute they start becoming a little forgetful, it's your first thought as to this is it.
Right.
What can you do? Stress reduction, take a long walk, yoga, meditation, listening to music, getting yourself involved in new activities. Sometimes as we get older, we stop playing and we become very, very serious. We stop doing things that are really enjoyable to us. Tennis, golf, leisure activities that we just don't feel we have the time for.
You say that one of the greatest problems is not the behavior by the patient, one of those unwanted behaviors, but the reaction by the loved one or the caregiver.
Yes, and working with the families that I've been working with, like over 10,000 families, it really comes down to the majority of times the behavioral issues are oftentimes due to the family members. They're incapability at sometimes of backing away. When somebody becomes repetitive, after a while you sort of blow your top a little bit. Oftentimes it's also the fact that they're very disappointed in the fact that they expect too much. So basically I work a lot with families in helping them to understand unrealistic expectations, why this person, your loved one, is no longer capable. They look, as we've heard, she looks like she's in great health. She's healthy as an ox, it's just her brain. So what happens for caregivers is we expect that person to still perform the tasks and duties that they always did based on the way they present. And at times, nothing could be further than the truth.
And next caller, this is Maria in South Miami. Hi there.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on the show. I'm so glad you're doing this.
Good.
I just put my mom in home hospice for what they tell me is Alzheimer's, although even just diagnosing it has been a challenge because some people say it's arteriosclerosis, some people say it's vascular dementia, you know, and at this point it's just like she's old, the caboose isn't working anymore, okay? But she's there spiritually. And then the problem is when you have a couple, because my father has early dementia, but maybe he's just old, all right? And he's forgetful. And then, you know, what do you do with a couple who's, one is not so bad, but one is in bed bound? And then I myself, I've been taking care of my parents for 6 years, and I've lost work, and and my siblings, God bless them, but they're not really like fully cooperating. So I'm really concerned about the way that, you know, people have babies. You also have to plan to have parents. When you're born to your family, you have to plan to take care of your parents sometime later on in the future. It's not just about retirement and money. Yes, of course, it's important. Save your money. You have a nest egg. But the emotional toll of this has affected me incredibly. I'm a journalist. I had to quit my job and give up everything because no one is helping me to take care of them. And you know how, you know, you, when you're in the airplane, you put the mask on yourself before you put it on your child. It's the same thing. And I wish, you know, I'm so glad that there's this dialogue right now, because we're the sandwich generation. My parents are in their 80s. They're baby boomers. And people need to prepare. You know, it's part of your family planning.
And unfortunately, you've really hit the nail with the hammer, because what you're saying right now resonates with hundreds of thousands of individuals that are caring for a person with dementia. The one thing I can honestly say that would help, and I know it really helped me, but it's a thing called boundaries. And for all of us caregivers, we know what our limit is and what we can do and what we can't do anymore. And as the disease progresses, sometimes it progresses so slowly that we don't even recognize the fact that we've really taken on a lot more responsibility than we ever imagined. And what I do oftentimes with clients is we sit down and we talk about what's going on, getting the family members involved. As you said, they're not doing anything. And as I usually say is, it's not about what they're doing for mom and dad anymore. You're the sibling. It's how they're helping you out. And so that takes it a little bit away from the fact that they're not doing anything for their parents, because different people have different experiences with mom and dad.
Right.
But this way, then we put it back to where it belongs as a sibling, sibling to sibling. You know, I need your help. And it's sometimes the way we ask for help. We think we might be asking for help, but actually we're not. Or if somebody offers us help, we're like, no, don't worry about it. I can take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you take it wherever you can get it from. And there's a lot of services, believe it or not, in South Florida that will be able to help you. You just have to know where to go and who to ask and how to ask.
We have an emailer. Mary wants to know that she said she read a New York Times article about a year ago that three vitamins, B12, B6, and folic acid seem to help in the prevention of Alzheimer's. Is there anything on that, doctor?
The vitamins mentioned will not necessarily prevent Alzheimer's disease. They do not help the course of it. If someone has a deficiency of one of those, it can make a difference. But there's no hardcore data showing that it has an impact on Alzheimer's disease per se. There are supplements out there, and there's lots of smaller studies that indicate maybe it might help some people with memory function, but we really want to go on, is there good scientific evidence supporting them? And in that case, there really isn't.
And another quick one, Carolina, is there any benefit to taking Algal DHA daily for preventing Alzheimer's?
DHA is a component of fish oil, has omega-3 fatty acids in it. There is no good scientific evidence that it's going to either prevent or treat Alzheimer's disease. I know there's a lot of anecdotal stories out there, and everyone has their supplement or their potion, whatever that they think helps, but when it really comes down to it, I can speak to you as a researcher who has spent my entire career looking at these things. Most of the people come in are on fixed incomes. The last thing I'm going to do is ask them to spend money on something which does not have clear evidence that it benefits from them. I understand hope. I understand that sometimes if someone believes something works, it can have a very powerful effect for a given period of time. But at the end of the day, we want to use medications that are approved by the FDA because there's evidence that they work.
We're talking about Alzheimer's disease on today's Topical Currents, and we'll get to more of your calls and emails. We're speaking with Natalie Rubenstein of Alzheimer's Care Consultants, AlzheimersCareConsultants.com, and Dr. Mark Agronin, who's at the Miami Jewish Health Systems. We'll take that break and be right back.
I'm WLRN America's editor, Tim Padgett. Whether it's markets in Brazil, Marxists in Cuba, or music in Mexico, it's important to understand South Florida's connection to Latin America and the Caribbean. For business, politics, and culture from Tijuana to Tierra del Fuego, listen Wednesday for the Latin America Report, made possible by Espirito Santo Bank and Morrison, Brown, Argies, and Farah, certified public accountants and advisors.
The Miami Dance Festival kicks off its 2014 season with a shared performance by host company, Momentum Dance Company, and the PGK Dance Project from San Diego on April 5th at 8 p.m. at the Byron Carlisle Theater on Miami Beach. Details at MomentumDance.com.
And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Dr. Mark Gronin, and also Natalie Rubenstein. Our topic today is Alzheimer's disease. We're at your service. We have some callers. Bonnie, why don't you run down some of the lists of websites that have been discussed that people can write down? And we will be having these on our website at WLRN.org.
Yes.
And also the Topical Currents Facebook.
It might take a little longer than usual to get the links up there because our online producer is not in town. Okay, so what we have is MiamiJewishHealthSystems.org. MiamiJewishHealthSystems.org. We have the Miami Jewish Health Systems Research Hotline, and that's 305-514-8710, and that's for Dr. Mark Agronin, MarcAgronin.com. And Natalie Rubenstein is with AlzheimersCareConsultants.com and has also written the book Alzheimer's Disease and Other Dementias, The Caregiver's Complete Survival Guide.
And back to the phones, Marcia, she's in Sunrise. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
My mother-in-law has been diagnosed with a condition, I'm not sure if that's the right word, called aphasia. And she does have trouble putting sentences together and getting the right words out. But she also has trouble understanding the plot of a movie, for example, or a conversation that's going on around her. Is there some relationship between aphasia and Alzheimer's?
You're describing some of the cardinal symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Aphasia refers to language disturbance, both for understanding and speaking. That's one of the core symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. You also describe something we call agnosia, where someone has a difficult time recognizing familiar aspects of things, places, people, and then remembering it over time. And that may be why she has difficulty with the plot of a movie, or it could be short-term memory impairment as well. But yes, those are all part of any dementia, but in particular, core symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
Will this condition, these core symptoms would definitely lead to this Alzheimer's at a later period of her life?
The key thing in this circumstance is to get an evaluation, because what we do is we look at the symptoms, we look at the time course, we do a brain scan, we do blood work, we try to put the picture together and decide what is this most consistent with, because there are a number of different forms of dementia that also involve language disturbance. So without doing that evaluation, it's hard to know, and then it's hard to know what the best treatment will be. So the key thing is, if she has not had an evaluation at a memory center, you want to get that done.
Okay. Thank you very much for your help.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Steven's listening in northern New Jersey. He says his mother lives in Weston and was diagnosed with cerebral vasculitis last fall after suffering from a high fever. Over the last few months, films show that she's shown some brain shrinkage in her frontal lobe. Her short-term memory has been impaired, long-term memory good. 14 years ago, after replacement for a artificial heart valve, she had a stroke, a miraculous recovery after that. And he's saying her brain got completely rewired. She recovered all of her cognitive abilities. Is there any chance this time that with therapy she could possibly have another rewiring of her brain, or is it not a likely scenario?
Hopefully she could. A vasculitis is a condition when you get inflammation of blood vessels, usually small blood vessels. And so this can, if this occurs in the brain, absolutely can cause brain damage. Once it's under control, the hope is that you can get back function. And so in a circumstance like that, you'd want someone to get really aggressive therapy, in particular a cognitive rehabilitation, and hope that she can recover a lot of her function.
Okay, hope that helps, Stephen.
And we'll move along to Jan. She's in Miami also. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is about, is there any correlation that anybody has found between the attention deficit disorders and Alzheimer's, being that they're pretty much both information retention issues?
There's no link between attention deficit disorder and Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia, none that's been shown. But you raise a good point that I have seen individuals with adult ADD who have been misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And once we recognize that this is an attentional issue alone, it's not a progressive disease, we can take Alzheimer's disease off the map there. Again, it speaks to the importance of the workup, because in a comprehensive workup at a memory center, we do neuropsychological testing, and that will determine very clearly whether this is solely an attentional issue or whether there's short-term memory impairment and other symptoms that would make it consistent with either Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay,
Gary says, I keep hearing that Alzheimer's is a buildup of toxic protein in the brain. Has any research been done on an association between eating meat and Alzheimer's?
So yes, you are correct that the current theory holds that two toxic proteins, beta amyloid and an abnormal form of tau protein, appear to be, if not the cause of Alzheimer's disease, at least a main associated factors with it. There is no clear link between eating meat and developing Alzheimer's disease, aside from the fact that if someone eats a lot of meat and also has high cholesterol and they're at a risk for vascular problems, again, think about what I said earlier, that anything that impacts your heart will also impact your brain. So indirectly, you could see a link, but it's not considered a chief risk factor for Alzheimer's disease.
And we'll take another caller. This is Jody. She's in Margate. I'm a little short on time, Jody. Hi.
Hi. Listen, my mother had long-term health care. It was only worth $100 a day. Now, she never had dementia. Neither of my parents. It's not really been in my background. Now I'm a single woman. I am not currently employed, and I was told by one of the people here that is a helper that you need $200 a day. She never used it. Now I'm 50. I just turned 59. So, you know, it bothers me for long-term health care. How can I go about this,
Natalie?
Okay, are you asking about yourself or about your mother?
No, my mother has passed now.
Okay.
And she died of a stroke very quickly, and that was it.
Okay. One of the things with long-term care insurance, it's like any other kind of insurance. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Right.
A lot of people don't realize that. A lot of the older policies were $100 a day. At the time, that's how much it would cost approximately to have a live-in aide. Or it was $100 a day, which would be 30 times 30, which would have been $3,000 in an assisted living facility,
right,
which would have covered it.
Yeah.
It doesn't cover everything. But what happens is you can also work with agencies. Prices aren't set in stone. And if you're asking whether you could get it, my whole question to you would be is this. I don't have it for Alzheimer's or Pick's disease. I have it because of just living your life, driving on the roads. Anything can happen to you at any time. You could suffer a stroke. It's not just about getting it for dementia. It's getting it for anything as we get older, because right, we know how expensive that care can be.
One last emailer, Corinne, a study connecting sleep and Alzheimer's, suggesting that having more sleep can prevent it, since the body cleanses the brain. Doctor?
There are some potential links between sleep disorders and different forms of dementia. Most people who have a problem have obstructive sleep apnea, so throughout the night their brain is simply not getting enough oxygen, and that can certainly impact their cognition the following day. The good news is you can treat that, and that can reverse the effects of it. So it just speaks to the healthier the lifestyle you have, the lower risk of Alzheimer's disease, the better you'll do over time.
Okay, and on that note, yes, Natalie Rubenstein is with AlzheimersCareConsultants.com. We'll have a link on our website. Dr. Mark Agronin is with the Miami Jewish Health Systems.org. And that number again is 305-514-8710. Thank you very much for being with us today, both of you.
Yeah. And that's today's At Your Service edition. Apologies to those callers that we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. And if you'd like a friend or relative to hear today's program, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, discussion, and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. Tomorrow, we're with the author of a book about the making of the classic movie Network. It won 4 Academy Awards and shaped the way we think about corporate power and media. I'm mad as hell. To the calendar on this day in 1878, 136 years ago, the birth of Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champion in Galveston, Texas. He held the title for 8 years. And on this day in 1973, 41 years ago, heavyweight Ken Norton beats Muhammad Ali in a split decision. Ali's jaw was broken in the fight. Norton lost 2 other bouts with Ali. And one more while we muse on the very distant, distant memory of Dolphins Super Bowls. On this day in 1974, 40 years ago, Miami stars Zonka, Kick, and Warfield signed with the WFL's Toronto Northmen, which then became the Memphis Southmen. Then the Grizzlies. The league folded 2 years later. So we leave with a thought from Muhammad Ali, who had a 56-5 record for his glorious career. Quote, "The man who views the world at 50 the same as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.
Palm Beach Drama Works presents